This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Hi, Maeve.
Hi. Thank you for having me again.
thank you for joining me. Welcome to you and everyone to Social Distance, the Atlantic's podcast about the pandemic. I'm James Hamblin. You can call me Jim. And with me today is Maeve Higgins, sitting in for Catherine Wells.
But you can call me Jim.
And I will also call you Jim, just so everything's confusing. It's been 2 weeks since we spoke, Maeve. How have you been?
It has. I've been fine. I've been putting into practice one of your pieces that you wrote, not about the coronavirus. It was before that. It was about press-ups or about push-ups. Do you remember?
Push-ups, which you call press-ups. Is that just you or is that regional?
So I guess you do not call them press-ups, but it's the same thing.
I would think of pressing as more something that would be done with like a finger, like pressing a button.
Oh, that's how I do push-ups.
Oh.
Wait, you don't do push-ups just on one finger? Dude, that's the easiest way.
Oh.
Well, I guess that's what I'm working on. I don't really know. I remembered this piece that you wrote and it was like, don't worry about BMI, but do worry about this one thing. And then you said something like, I'm quoting you directly, by the way. Then you said something like, you know, if you want to check if you're going to, you know, live a long, healthy life, like maybe check if you can just do a press up, you know?
And yeah. Okay. I remember that. That was a story from 2019 or so about a study that kind of said, you know, BMI, body weight, isn't a great indicator of health. All these other things aren't necessarily, but whether you can do one push up is actually a very good sign. It's a meaningful sign about health in a way that some of these other numbers that we ascribe aren't. What made you think of that?
Because I tried to do one and I was like, oh my, this is important. I know somewhere in my brain, it was like your like little careful voice being like, this means something. So I checked, I Googled like Hamblin, the Atlantic push-ups. You want to see the pictures that came up? No, it was all above board. There was no pictures of you doing them, but it was this really interesting piece. So I've been working on that in the snow and the rain and everything.
Cool. That's a nice attainable goal, right? Mm-hmm. Like so often when people make fitness goals, they're like, I'm going to work out an hour a day, every day, indefinitely. And this is like a quantifiable thing that is actually doable.
Yeah. And you can see results really fast. Like I said, I'm clapping. I'm doing them on one finger. I'm still sitting while I'm doing them, but they're getting more.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Moving into a horizontal position is like next level.
But yeah.
You gotta start
that's
somewhere.
For the next pandemic. But Jim, I'm really glad to be here today because a lot of the things that we're going to talk about, I'm very curious about. I've been listening to the voicemails and poking around in your inbox. And do you want to hear one? There's a listener named Chris. He's actually in New York and he left a voicemail.
Oh, right here in New York. Yeah. I love listening to voicemails. Let's do that.
Same.
Hi. I have a question about vaccine manufacturing. I was wondering if can you do something that we do for like generic drugs? Like, can we have it so Pfizer, Moderna, or Johnson & Johnson would give their formula, just make it public and allow other countries or other vaccine makers to just copy their process and increase the supply? I know obviously there's like business reasons, you know, because they want to make money, but I think it would make sense for, you know, maybe the Gates Foundation or a country to just pay made probably Johnson & Johnson like $1 billion and just say like, you know, we're just going to make this available to everybody to manufacture so the whole world can have vaccines as quickly as possible. All right. Thank you.
So what do you think? Like, there is this vaccine shortage. That seems like a cool solution.
That does sound like a cool idea. Mm-hmm. And it's more complicated than that might seem, but I'm also not sure it needs to be more complicated.
I saw your tweet about it as well. You said the shortage doesn't need to exist. You know, yeah. Pfizer, Moderna, they could share the design with dozens of other pharma companies who stand ready to produce their vaccines and end the pandemic. And I was like, I'm going to give that one a retweet. But
yeah,
I guess...
thank you. You and you like then... 40 million other people. Well, I want to address that specifically.
Sure.
Because it became a source of much discussion, and I didn't word it exactly as I would have if I could go back. It's a little, for the exact same reason, that it's more complicated than that. And I think I implied that it, like, or at least I know the way people reacted to it, was that they thought that I was saying they could snap their fingers and this would happen and it would be super swift and easy. And I didn't mean that.
Yeah.
It's like when you say something like we actually have enough money in the world for everyone to have food and shelter.
Yeah.
We have the wealth and we have the capacity to do that. And then you get a bunch of people that are like, well, but there are all these laws that where rich people don't have to pay taxes, so we actually don't. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you're also right. But yeah. I didn't mean it in the sense of like, this is going to be easy and happen tomorrow. But I do think it's sort of the solution that's starting to happen and should have happened already.
I think you should. I mean, just as a communicator myself, you don't use enough emojis in your tweets about deadly viruses. So maybe you could do like a face, you know, with a monocle on, making a little like there's more to this.
Right. I feel like that should be appended to every tweet. Like, and like if you ever read a tweet and feel compelled to be like, well, it's actually not the entire story.
It's a tweet. It's so short.
Like everyone knows that. Hopefully, you should know that's not the entire story. Anyway, it's a lot more complicated than any single tweet. These are complicated vaccines to make and distribute. That doesn't mean it has to be so complicated and that we shouldn't make this more open technology. In any case, I'd like to talk to an expert on this about how that might happen and why it might not. So we're going to call Greg Gonzalez. He's been on the show before. He's an epidemiology professor at Yale School of Public Health, where I'm also a lecturer, full disclosure, and co-director of the Global Health Justice Partnership.
Yeah, I heard him on the show back in May with you and Catherine, and it was fascinating the way he spoke about the history of the AIDS pandemic.
Yeah, he, after a lot of advocacy work, got into academia, got his PhD, became a professor, and started studying, global infectious disease eradication. So he'll be very helpful in terms of talking to us about the logistics of why things aren't happening and what is technically possible.
For sure. And we should explain to the listeners that we were waiting for his availability. He's obviously so busy, but that's why we're a day late. It's nothing to do with Jim's cosmetic surgery.
No. I couldn't think of anyone better to talk to than Greg about this, and he's been very busy, but he's here now. So thank you for waiting on the episode.
Yes. So let's give him a call.
Hey, I'm here.
Hey, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, fine.
Maeve is sitting in for Catherine today.
Hi, Maeve.
Hi, nice to meet you. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, anytime.
Greg, we got a listener question asking, basically, if we could just have governments produce generic versions of the vaccines that are out there, and why isn't that already happening more widely? And I was wondering if maybe we could start with that idea and then sort of work backwards to what you've written about specifically. Yeah.
Sure. So As you may know, vaccines are complex biological molecules. You know, in the case of the mRNA vaccines, nucleic acid wrapped in these lipid nanoparticles. Most therapies, drugs we put into our bodies in pill form are simple molecules, right? They're easy to produce. It's like you have the recipe, you can make the recipe in another factory. And in the context of the AIDS epidemic, you know, many companies around the world produced generic versions of patented branded antiretrovirals, which made it possible to put millions and millions of people on AIDS drugs over the past 20 years. The problem with vaccines is they are complex amalgamations of different kinds of chemical entities, and you can't just follow a recipe. If I started a company and I wanted to take Moderna's mRNA vaccine and produce it, I probably wouldn't know exactly how to produce that exact formula and construct that vaccine in the same way, and I'd have to do new clinical trials. It's not a simple question of sort of making a generic vaccine. That being said, many people, including my colleagues, had an op-ed a few weeks ago calling for a president's emergency plan for vaccine access and relief. And they made a case that we should have public production of vaccines. So a company like Moderna or Pfizer would be asked by the government in no uncertain terms, help us build a government factory to make your vaccine, or help us retrofit another factory to do so. Not so crazy to think about, because Lonza is making Moderna's vaccine as a contracted manufacturing plant. So it's not impossible to do. It requires the ability to exactly reproduce what Moderna does for its vaccine in a set of other plants. So public production, not just to expand access in the United States and deal with these vaccine limitations, but to do it for the rest of the world under the president's emergency plan for vaccine access and relief, modeled on PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief that President Bush announced in the early 2000s. I think what people are also thinking about is not just public production in the United States, but why not tech transfer from companies in the global north to places that have domestic pharmaceutical manufacturing capability, like South Africa, Brazil, Thailand, and others, that could profit from greater worldwide supply of these vaccines.
Can you clarify just one thing for me? So you mentioned a smaller pharmaceutical company is doing contract work with Moderna. I know other smaller companies are doing the same. So how is it possible that they're able to quickly become able to produce these vaccines, but companies that aren't under contract from Moderna aren't?
So at some point in the development process of Moderna's vaccine, they said, we're going to need to scale up. So they went to Lonza and said, we're going to come in and tell you exactly what you have to do. This is the kind of machinery, the kind of vats, the kind of, you know, lipid particle processing, your RNA synthesizing machines, et cetera. And so they gave them very explicit line-by-line instructions on how to do it. The reason that you and I couldn't, as theoretical pharmaceutical company owners, is just do it on our own is because we don't know those details.
What if they made a, like, YouTube video series?
If they did an actual formal tech transfer agreement with our company, that would be fine. I mean, that's what we're talking about in public production, is that the government could say, you know what, it's not that expensive in the long run to build up mRNA vaccine capacity. We're not going to do it today, but in 6 months to 8 months to a year, just as Moderna had to do over the course of 2020, we can build up capacity to do this. Moderna, Pfizer, we're going to sit you down and, well, actually, Moderna, you took billions of dollars from us. We're not even going to sit you down. You're going to do this. And you're going to help our new contractors around the country and up in Canada and Mexico set up production facilities so we can pump out more of your mRNA vaccines.
Right.
That's totally possible.
Is the reluctance there, like, I mean, the stakes are so high. There's such a shortage in the US. And then you mentioned worldwide, right, in the global south. So, you know, why is there a reluctance to kind of hurry that along, do you think?
So cash is king. I mean, I don't want to be crude, but Moderna is pretty clear that you pay to play, right? Mm-hmm. And we bought up a whole bunch of the vaccine supply in the global north because we could, you know, we were where you're going to get the best bang for your R&D buck. You know, since the early AIDS epidemic, well, actually since the 2000s, when we were having these discussions about generic medicines, you know, many foundations like the Gates Foundation and others said, you know, if you're going to develop vaccines, drugs, diagnostics for the globe, you need to have some sort of global access policy. And there was something put into place in many foundation agreements and others that said, if you take our money, you have to agree to affordable pricing and access to the rest of the world, largely for drugs. But CEPI also initially had done this for vaccine development. And in 2019, they reneged on it. Right before the pandemic, they took out this affordable pricing global access clause out of their licensing agreements, leading MSF, Doctors Without Borders, to go after them in no uncertain terms to say that they were rolling the clock backwards in terms of equitable access to biomedical technologies right before COVID hit. So, you know, the point is that corporations don't want to give away things for free. You know, in the case of Moderna, taxpayers in the U.S. invested billions in the development of that immunogen, right? We're not asking for something for free. We already paid for it. And we don't need necessarily to pay for it two times around. Countries around the world, rich countries, are paying, what, $60, $70 per dose to Moderna to supply their own domestic needs. Mm-hmm. What we need to do and what we've said across the past 20 years is that, yes, make your buck back in the global north, but you need to make it free and accessible across the rest of the world. And, you know, basically, the Trump administration had no plan for distribution and scale up anyway, but surely didn't think anything about the rest of the world and the rest of the world's needs. Sadly, you know, this is the case with many of the other sort of countries around the world as well. Nobody's sort of planned for global distribution and scale up. COVAX is saying maybe we're going to hit 20%, 25%, 27% of coverage in 92 low-income countries by the end of this year. But others are going to have to wait until 2022, 2023 to get access to these.
So like one in five people in 92 low-income countries.
Yeah. And I think when you figure out all the sort of low-income countries, it's like 3% of the world's poor get access to these vaccines.
You know, 3%. Yeah. 3%. Wow.
I mean, it's sort of grotesque, like from an ethical perspective, it's criminal. But, you know, as we're talking about all these new variants.
It's also really dumb.
It's really dumb. I mean, we're just basically, if you're interested in pushing a virus to evolve to evade your vaccines, the best way to do it is low level pressure from incomplete partial vaccination of your population over a long period of time.
Oh my God.
And we already know that some of the variants have had some luck, and some have been about expanded transmissibility, like the B117 variant that was found in the UK. There's some sense that this new variant, which was first described in the context of South Africa, might be less susceptible to the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Right.
You know, think of 3 years of low-level vaccination around the world and the sort of plethora of variants that's going to come spewing out across the globe, potentially being resistant to the current Moderna vaccine, the current Pfizer vaccine, the current Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We're going to be chasing variants around the globe for the foreseeable future and basically have made a death pact for endemic spread of this virus. It's never going to go away, right? We're now in a path where we're going to have these cycles of coronavirus outbreaks as there are gaps in vaccination across the U.S. and across the world, and as new variants emerge that might be less susceptible to vaccines that we put out into the field.
Right. I knew it was wrong what was happening, but I didn't realize it was also kind of creating these excellent conditions. So the virus has, like, as you put it, like more luck too, right?
I mean, we could be lucky. Maybe these variants don't emerge that escape the ability to be neutralized by the antibodies raised by these vaccines. But, you know, we have millions of people infected, hundreds of millions of people infected. This virus is not as great a sort of mutation generator as HIV because it has a proofreading enzyme. But the sheer number of infections that are happening are a recipe for viral variation emerging over the course of the next few months and years. And as we put things in its way that are actually not good enough to stop it in its tracks, it starts to push it down an evolutionary pathway to resist these half measures that we throw at it.
Yeah. So the half measures can ultimately be dangerous for the world. Even if, you know, the wealthy countries, you know, didn't have a sense of morality or obligation to just basic equity issues, there was, you know, it's just not in their own personal interest. It's dangerous to their own citizens to not think about this problem in the right way. Yeah.
And we said this in the context of the AIDS epidemic. You know, it's like, unless you deal with HIV, it's always going to be haunting the planet. You know, people are like, you know what, we have antiretroviral therapy in the US, we can manage the disease. Sorry. Now we have a disease where it really doesn't care where you live. It doesn't need sex or drugs to transmit itself. It just sort of, you know, close personal contact without the requisite preventive measures in place. So the self-preservation instinct right now should be really strong with us about getting global vaccination coverage quickly, broadly across the globe. But I don't think people are thinking straight. I think they're like, so sort of looking inward about their national situations that they really don't understand that, like, we're all at risk until none of us are basically at risk.
Right.
Yeah. The expression haunting the planet is chilling me here. It's a really effective way of explaining, like, I guess what the AIDS pandemic is still doing. And I wonder if you could tell us about, like, are some countries doing better or worse? Is anybody doing a good job?
Well, you know, it's funny. Everybody's not doing great right now. You know, we're under 10% vaccination in the US. It's not like Europe is doing much better than that. You know, maybe by the second half of this year into the early 2022, we'll have widely immunized most places in Europe, maybe into the half of 22, larger chunks of the world like Russia, Canada, China, India. So, you know, we're not on a target to sort of widespread vaccination even here until, you know, probably later this year. Everybody else is going to be way behind. And then, as I said, some people are going to be waiting for 2 to 3 years to get vaccines, you know, and who knows what happens as viral variants emerge and people start to scramble to develop vaccines to their own countries, targeting the new variants and forget about the needs of other countries once again.
Right. Oh, so we could be like, sorry, we need our second round of updates before you even get one.
Yeah. Sorry, screwed it up the first time and now we're going to screw it up again.
Yeah.
I like that nice apologetic tone that you took there in your in that little role play where you were America saying sorry to the rest of the world.
Except we probably wouldn't say sorry. Greg, you've studied the AIDS pandemic for a long time. And I think from a U.S. perspective, that's often thought about or talked about as a phenomenon of the 80s and early 90s. But the global deaths peaked in 2004. This seems like we might be on a similarly narrow-minded trajectory. How do we risk repeating that problem of, you know, improperly conceptualizing the scope of what we're dealing with here?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is, you know, global deaths may have peaked in 2004, but in the American South, if you're a Black gay man, 50% chance that in your lifetime you're going to be HIV positive. In the context of U.S. healthcare, you know, it's not clear that you're going to get access to the drugs that keep me alive on a day-to-day basis. And there's still not widespread full coverage of antiretrovirals in the global South. So deaths may have peaked, but, you know, we still have this fulminant epidemic in the U.S., except it's you know, the New York Times Magazine every 10 years writes an article about the hidden epidemic in the United States, but it's there for anybody who wants to see it. And so, you know, we basically have no chance of real containment and eradication of HIV in my lifetime. The sad thing about SARS-CoV-2 is that because it's airborne, because it's communicable in a much more general way than a sexually transmitted or bloodborne transmitted disease like HIV, is that the stakes are so much higher. And so we've talked about sort of what happens with incomplete vaccination and the emergence of variants. But, you know, everybody wants to go back to normal. And having waves of coronavirus infections coming across the planet that we have to tackle with new vaccines every few years because a variant emerges, or even just because, you know, there's pockets of vaccination that allow the virus to sort of pop out like we see for certain childhood diseases in different places around the U.S. We're just going to sort of be living in a new normal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it could reshape our lives very much like sort of big catastrophic moments in modern history have done to generations before us. You know, we weren't prepared for it. We're not rising to the challenge in a way that's going to make quite a bit of difference. The sad thing, and as you both know, is that, you know, this isn't going to be our last time at the rodeo, right? Like, pandemics, you know, will come at us, AIDS, Ebola, H1N1, swine flu, this now, what's going to be next? If we had a chance to scale it up, you know, worldwide vaccine production and readiness, if you can't do it in the midst of a global pandemic, when does it ever get real for anybody, right?
Right.
So that's the thing that scares me the most, is that as a species, we are, you know, we're playing with fire. So,
well, if we could bring it back to kind of just where we started, it sounds like we're in a moment right now where we could either accept this new normal where there are just indefinitely, globally, large numbers of people who are sickened and dying from SARS-CoV-2 and from future variants of that, or we could, you know, aggressively try to stamp this out by ramping up vaccination in creative ways, like, you know, making these a public good. we started here talking also about a tweet that I had that was not well worded, but that got a lot of criticism for the idea that a lot of places around the world could produce these vaccines if we were to think out of the box in sort of the ways you're describing too. And I got a lot of pushback, just like, no, it's not possible. You know, only Pfizer and Moderna can basically make these vaccines. I guess you've done advocacy work. You know about effective approaches to like helping people to not accept the status quo. What can we do in this moment to avoid going down that route of just, this is the best we can do. This is the normal, the way vaccines are made, and we'll do our best.
So could we tomorrow make double the amount of Moderna vaccine with another contractor or other company to do it? No.
Sure.
But it took a year for the company to scale up their production capability. And we know that's true because there was no SARS-CoV-2 a year ago in our imaginations or the idea that there was going to be any vaccine development. So if there was political will, the US and other rich countries could underwrite a global production plan, you know, for mRNA vaccines, right? You know, maybe there's other vaccine platforms that we can talk about too, but these are the two approved ones. And we could make a plan, figure out who's going to pay for it, and then tell Moderna, tell Pfizer, tell Johnson & Johnson, we're going to do this as a global community. If NIH wants to exercise its patent rights and tell Moderna you're going to do it, use it or lose it, we can do that too. They're going to have to provide tech transfer. We can remunerate them for whatever they want, and we get that up and running. And so in 6 months to a year, there's more capacity to get these highly effective vaccines out there.
Yeah,
I think the other piece of this is global genomic surveillance. We barely know what's going on in the US in terms of these variants. And we're going to need to have a sense of like, what's the map of variant emergence across the globe? And what is the impact of them on vaccine susceptibility? We need like an international global research platform tracking down variants, looking at the ways in which it might evade immunity now and in the future, and use that to help develop plans for different kinds of vaccine distribution across the world, different kinds of vaccine development over time. And so it's totally possible to do. People are saying, yeah, we can't flip a switch and change everything. And Derek Lowe, who writes for Science Magazine, has said this in a column, you know, we can't do this right away. The point is, we can do it. We can't do it.
Yes.
We can't do it tomorrow.
I didn't mean to imply we could do it tomorrow. I realize it kind of read that way, but that seems to be like, just because we can't do it tomorrow doesn't mean it's not doable. And
but they wanted to shut you up. They wanted to shut you up. They wanted to tell you it was impossible and that it, you know, it's not like a generic drug. No, we can't do it. We can't do the capacity. You know, the point is like, there's a lot of people saying, you know, or throwing up obstacles in the way to do it. When I just think it's making a large global business plan about how we're going to do this.
Are you saying, you know, this vaccine manufacturing step, it's about the pandemic either becoming permanent or not becoming permanent?
Well, like, being permanent, not being permanent, or being worse or worsest or most worse. You know, the point is like, if we accept the status quo, it's going to be gruesome for the planet.
Horrifying, yeah.
Horrifying, both from the epidemiological and the sort of humanitarian perspective. And so, you know, President Biden is a far better steward of our pandemic future, but I don't think he's thinking globally right now. I don't think any of the European leaders are thinking this way. And then when they look back, they at the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria, we all give like $1 billion here and there. And, you know, this is a much larger global health lift than anything we've done before. It's not impossible, but people have to basically say, you know what? Vaccine coverage broadly and as quickly as possible is an international goal. It's not based on charity, slightly a little bit, but for mostly it's self-preservation, because we're going to be asked to do this again with another pandemic. We're going to be asked to do this as global climate change comes creeping up on us.
Right.
At some point, we're going to have to make a collective decision to act together for our collective self-interest. But right now, it's every man and woman for himself, every pharmaceutical company for themselves. So we're not on the right path yet, even though things are looking up in the United States in terms of the national leadership. But the global situation is pretty catastrophic.
Yeah.
While we have you, just for the last few minutes, I read your piece in The Atlantic about your personal experience with the vaccine, and I found it so fascinating. Could you talk us through how you grappled with your own decision about getting the vaccine now? Because you were offered the vaccine before your elderly mother.
Yeah, I was offered before my elderly mother, but you know, if you look at my Facebook feed or other people's Facebook feed, you know, everybody's showing these vaccination cards, you know, and you're going, wait, you're a 30 something medical student, or you're seeing these sort of bizarre trajectories of who's getting vaccinated in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and when you look at the data, it's depressing because the zip codes in which there's high high death rates are also the same place that there are low vaccination rates.
This, in the same way that we don't have a global sort of centralized strategy for equitable distribution, we don't even have one in the U.S. We're just giving them to states, and states are doing it individually.
It's chaos, a little bit of chaos.
Yeah.
And your personal sense of fairness, your choice was you were going to wait and get the vaccine later. Right.
There's conflicting advice there from ethicists about whether you need to take it or, you know, if it's the system's fault and you are just participating in a bad system or what. Anyway, future episodes. Greg, thank you so much for all your insight, as always. And I hope we'll talk to you later on down the road and things look better.
Thanks, James and Mate.
Thanks for everything.
All right, cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Maeve, do you remember when we spoke with Ruth Faden from Hopkins?
I was just thinking about her. Yeah.
I spoke to her since then, and she kind of addressed this question of, say, if you're in a position to get vaccinated and you know that there are people in other states, as there certainly are in other countries, who are, you know, more in need of this vaccine than you are. You know, there are healthcare workers in Africa who aren't doctors and nurses who are not vaccinated. And, you know, they're going to be young, healthy adults in the U.S. who are going to get vaccinated before them, it seems.
Right. Did she come down on hot people need to be saved?
No, I mean, I think she didn't feel that even warranted her time. but she said, you know, the first and foremost guiding principle is we can't let any of these go to waste. And
yes,
that it's not necessarily wrong to take it if you are within a system that is telling you it's your turn to take it. Because if you refuse it, it doesn't mean it's going to be flown to Africa. So, you know, I think as in the coming months, you know, most Americans are going to have an opportunity to have this, and most of the world is not going to be vaccinated. And yet at an individual level, the responsible thing to do is sort of, you know, work for a more equitable world, but for now, take your shot.
Yeah, I really appreciate, like, you know, that Greg wrote about that and just talked it through and helps me think things like that through.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed our conversation with her as well, because, I mean, I'm sure you've seen, like, the doctor who gave them out got fired. You know, like, there's all this stuff going on. And
yeah, like, we're policing the little fires instead of building a better system.
Right. Meanwhile, did you hear when he said HIV continues to haunt the planet? I was like, oh my God, here comes another frightening, you know, undead virus that's just going to keep coming back.
Yeah.
It's very poetic, very spooky.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. We just take these things for granted once they've been around long enough that we just start to think, oh, it's an unsolvable problem.
He's just so straight up with what's happening. Yeah. But there was one point, and Greg said, you know, as you both know, we're in it for the long haul. I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
How long?
I know.
I have to keep relearning that, like, because my poor brain is like, you know, it's nearly over. But yeah.
Yeah. That's like this mistake we keep repeating, right? Like at the beginning, people were like, oh, how long is it going to be? 2 weeks? A month? And then, wait a minute, it might go on until summertime. Wait a minute, it might be with us all year. And then now, like, we just keep insisting that there's some end. And there could be, if we wanted to, do this global vaccination strategy.
Yeah, that sounds so cool. And like, because I don't want to be, you know, those the kind of jolly British generals, like before World War One, and they were like, don't worry, boys, you'll be home by Christmas. And all the boys went marching off for like 4 years.
Is that what happened?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a big, messy, long-winded war because nobody got it together to just clean it up.
Yeah. So, I guess that's how most wars start, isn't it? There, nobody's like, well, we're going to be doing this for the next three decades.
Oh, certainly not. Especially not World War One. Like, that was just basically a series of mishaps and a series of, you know, I want to go over there now. And you go first, though. Whoops. Sorry. That was a real mess. But again, it was self-interest that led to, you know, the decimation of whole populations instead of just being like, actually, let's think about the greater good. Oh, Jim, don't make me teach you all this stuff.
Next week, we will talk about World War One. Did it need to happen? Did we learn anything from it?
Our guest, Franz Ferdinand. Yeah. yeah. So how are you doing otherwise?
Just got my third dose of the Pfizer vaccine, so I'm feeling ultra strong. No, I didn't, just to be totally clear, I've had no doses of any vaccine yet.
You hang around with ethicists and they can't decide whether they want theirs or not, and then you get theirs too. Yeah.
For journalism. I have a lot of hope. If we can end this on a hopeful note, Maeve, you know, I mean, for as much as we're talking about careful, deliberate distribution and ways around shortages, it does seem like in the US and the UK, very soon, everyone who wants to have a vaccine will have one. And we need to think more globally about how to make that a bigger picture. But for in our worlds, at least, you know, soon all these questions of distribution by county or zip code should hopefully be behind us. But that doesn't mean it'll be over. Mm-hmm. Maeve, do you want to do the credits since I know you like doing the credits?
Just don't throw me, okay? But I do want you to hum underneath me when I'm doing them. Okay. Social Distance is produced by Kevin Townsend with help from senior producer AC Valdez. Write to us, please, at socialdistance@theatlantic.com or leave us a voicemail at 202-642-6487. That is Jim's phone number.
No, that's
not. If you like this show and want
voicemail
access to...
box where you can feel free to leave a voicemail.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Jim's number. 917. Just kidding. I'm not allowed to have it. Okay. If you like this show and want access to all of The Atlantic's journalism, the best way to do that is by subscribing to theatlantic.com/support us.
And a reminder about that survey I mentioned at the top. We love making this show and it helps us to know who we're making it for. So if you could go to theatlantic.com/social distance survey and answer a few quick questions, that would help us improve and make everything better for you.
You said love making.
I think you're not getting enough sleep, Maeve. Thank you for talking today. I hope to talk to you again soon.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Joe.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, Jim. Thank you. I actually genuinely got no sleep last night. That's so funny that you picked up on that.
Use that, Kevin. I have I'm a great doctor.